Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Caribbean Studies. I'm Dan Levesey, and today I'm speaking with Catherine Paugh, and we'll be discussing her new book, The Politics of Reproduction, Race, Medicine, and Fertility in the Age of Abolition. Catherine, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me in, Dan.
So let's just kind of start with what drew you to this topic. Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Caribbean Studies. I'm Dan Levesey, and today I'm speaking with Catherine Paugh, and we'll be discussing her new book, The Politics of Reproduction, Race, Medicine, and Fertility in the Age of Abolition. Catherine, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me in, Dan.
So let's just kind of start with what drew you to this topic. So you're looking at the Caribbean, you're looking at issues of reproduction in the age of slavery and the transition to abolition and emancipation. And how did you get into this field?
You know, I actually started out researching the history of midwifery in the Caribbean. I was really intrigued by the history of midwifery because it seemed to me from my studies that it was a place where women in the early modern world were able to exercise quite a bit of authority. Midwives in early modern societies around the Atlantic world were responsible for all sorts of kind of pivotal decisions in their societies about fatherhood, about sex, about reproduction. And I was curious that although there's been a lot of work on the history of midwifery in the Atlantic world, in various parts of the Atlantic world, in Europe, in North America, there had not been much on the Caribbean and on the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries, which was my particular field of interest. So I went into this hoping to write a history of midwifery, but what I found was that there were significant methodological challenges, that the history of midwives elsewhere in the Atlantic world had been written using diaries, using published guides written sometimes by midwives themselves, whereas in the Caribbean, and looking at the history of enslaved midwives in particular, which was my goal, because most midwives were illiterate, there were not the same sources. So it was an interesting challenge. I still wanted to get at the lives of these women. What I ended up doing was using plantation papers pretty closely. And I managed to pull some interesting stories, which I'm sure we'll have a chance to discuss about the history of midwifery, from those plantation papers. The story in particular of this midwife named Doll, who worked on Newton Plantation in Barbados. But at the same time, I wanted to flesh that out, and I wanted to understand the world in which Doll was operating and the political and economic pressures that she had to contend with. And so it became a broader project about the political and economic history of reproduction in the Atlantic world during this period when slavery was coming to an end.
Yeah, and I think hopefully we can get, there's been some time talking about Doll because her story really is pretty fascinating, and it's great to uncover what her daily life was like and also the way that she had to navigate kind of her own field and also the pressures of the plantation too. Maybe just kind of take the broader look back and kind of flesh out the context of this period of time, because you're looking at the late 18th and the early 19th centuries. What were sort of the economics of reproduction in terms of slavery and the slave trade? So you really kind of cast this broad net to explain why the reproduction of enslaved people was so central to the politics and also the economics of how reformers and also how planters were envisioning the future of slavery. So could you just sort of sketch out what the broad parameters of that were?
Sure. Yeah. I think that the primary thing that reformers had to contend with as they began to think about whether or not to abolish the Atlantic slave trade was how to keep the British imperial economy going. And my book does focus primarily on the British Caribbean, how to keep the imperial economy going in the absence of the Atlantic slave trade, which made this a real kind of political and economic problem about reproduction. The British imperial economy was very much dependent on the labor of enslaved people. A kind of vast network of trade had sprung up around the institution of slavery. So that slave manufactured goods like sugar, commodities like indigo, rice, tobacco, and so on, all depended on the labor of slaves. And without some sustainable method of reproduction, that would have all collapsed. And so it's a scary project that they're taking on, and they have to give a lot of thought to what will take the place of the Atlantic slave trade. And so I find that British politicians, British slave owners, and a variety of other actors, doctors, missionaries, and so on, are all thinking about how to encourage reproduction in the British Caribbean during this period.
And one of the things that you talk about is the sort of views of African sexuality, but also their reproductive capabilities, their ability to bear children. How did that discourse come about? And then in what ways did there become a sort of racialized discourse around the reproduction of enslaved people?
Well, you know, I think that there's a lot of concern with encouraging enslaved Africans as a class to reproduce and to keep that class separate from the master class. And so it does take on this racialized tone of worrying about how to encourage this kind of racially specific and segregated reproduction that's necessary for that vision of a slave society.
Yeah. Are there certain African traditions that get kind of castigated, or are there certain practices that enslave women are undertaking that really get vilified?
Yeah, I think that it goes in a lot of different directions, this concern with reform, that you see doctors, as I said, missionaries, slave owners, all thinking about how to kind of reshape the behavior of enslaved people in ways that they hope will encourage reproduction. So on the one hand, there is a lot of concern with what the medical causes of infertility might be in slave societies, and concerns in particular with sexual health, sexual behavior. So there's a lot of concern about encouraging monogamous sexual relationships, encouraging Christian marital mores as a way of encouraging fertility. And a lot of kind of racially specific discourse about sexual promiscuity and its dangers that springs up around these political and economic concerns about reproduction.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that stands out is that you have sort of this European view and also the sort of white planter class view about how to moderate enslaved women's reproductive health and to get them to be more productive. But one of the things I really like about your book is that you do have this focus on what enslaved women themselves were doing to try to moderate or at least to oversee their reproduction. And so, as you mentioned earlier, you have this case of Dahl in Barbados, who's a midwife practicing on the Newton Plantation. And could you just say a little bit about sort of what her experiences were like, and maybe how she differed in her in her practices versus what some of the free society wanted for enslaved women?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, most births at Newton were attended by midwives. And it's what I did by tracing the work of these midwives in the plantation's ledgers, their account books, was that I was able to identify that there were both enslaved women who were kind of elite, like Dahl. Her mother had been a domestic servant. Her sister also was a sort of domestic servant, and most of her female relations, they were at least partly of mixed race. They had some European heritage, and yet they continued to labor on the plantation, but in these privileged roles. And one of those privileged roles was that Dahl took on the work of a midwife. So it's interesting that at Newton Plantation, that she was in competition for this work with white women of the managerial class. So these were white women who were kind of middling, not particularly wealthy, and many of them were actually fairly poor and desperate. And there was this contentious relationship between those most elite enslaved people like Dahl and these white women of the managerial class. And this plays out in some competition over what kinds of or how suitable, I guess I should say, these women were for the kind of work that they were doing, for supervising childbirth. So there was a particular concern with Dahl about her role in attending childbirth, and particularly there was an incident where she was accused of infanticide, where she was attending the birth of a baby to her niece. And in the aftermath, the plantation manager told the absentee owner in a letter that he suspected that that the women in the family had killed the child for reasons that were unclear. But it becomes clear, and it's so hard to find real details about these women's practices, but it becomes clear in that letter that there were concerns about the suitability of Dahl as a midwife, that the plantation manager kind of scolded her for not having having allowed a white woman to attend the birth and to see the baby after it was born.
One thing that I was sort of wondering is do you see a kind of a similar tension between this idea of midwives and the sort of professionalization or attempted professionalization of childbirth in this period? That's maybe similar to kind of Laurel Ulrich's famous book, The Midwife's Tale. Is there a kind of similar or competing tension that's going on in the Caribbean at this time?
Yeah, you know, there were doctors working in the Caribbean. I think that that they were outnumbered in some ways. The racial divide is not the same where as in parts of the U.S. Where there's rarely a black majority. So certainly in Ulrich's book, there's really no discussion of race or of racial tensions. In the Caribbean, what I found is that there were doctors who attended the plantations, and then sometimes tried to make a little something extra for themselves by going back to Great Britain and writing books about slave care, the management of slave health. And these doctors frequently included chapters or large sections of their book on how to encourage reproduction. So these books would have been read by absentee planters who aspired to transform the management of their plantations. But they didn't necessarily reflect the reality of what was going on Caribbean plantations. And the work that I've done looking at account books from Newton Plantation indicates that, in fact, doctors rarely attended childbirth at Newton Plantation during this period. I found, I think, two instances where there was a very difficult birth and a doctor was called in. But the vast majority of the child care attendance was being done by these poor white and elite Afro-Caribbean women.
Maybe one final question about that, just because I think it's an important issue. Do you see much evidence, or can we really get at what enslaved women were trying to do in terms of their own reproduction? So beyond Dahl and midwives who were attending childbirth, there's a lot that you talk about in terms of reformers really vilifying enslaved women for promiscuous practices, for African traditions, which they think are harming reproduction. And is there any way to get at what enslaved women were doing themselves? I mean, did the plantation accounts give us much sense about how everyday enslaved women were trying to balance their lives in terms of reproduction, or how they were taking care of their own reproductive health? Is there much that we can really tell from the sources?
Yeah, I think that this is another kind of methodological challenge. And yet I do think that it's possible to bring out of the sources that were written primarily by white men during this period, some sense of what Afro-Caribbean women were doing. I haven't found the account books so rich for detail about childbirth practices, but I do find those doctors' accounts that frequently, even though the doctors are kind of dismissive and don't think much at all of Afro-Caribbean women's practices, and we still get a glimpse of what those practices were, and also of where these doctors and slave owners in some cases encountered resistance. So one example would be Matthew Lewis, who was raised in Great Britain, but heir to a couple of West India estates, and visited them in the 19th century. His diary discusses a few instances where enslaved women pushed back against the new practices that were being implemented by doctors in the Caribbean. For example, he tells the story of a group of enslaved women from a neighboring plantation who came to him complaining about attempts to force them to wean their children too early. That these women had banded together and marched over to his plantation. They'd heard he was a sympathetic ear to let him know that that these attempts to force them to wean their children in their first or second year, that this was too early. And he records that one woman said, my child is going to end up dead as a result of this. And it was really emphatic. And of course, Lewis is dismissive of their concerns, but we know from that there were passionate attempts by Afro-Caribbean women to push back against some of these practices. I also have seen doctors complaining about Afro-Caribbean women who object to attempts to force them to give birth in hospitals, and who insist on continuing to give birth in their own quarters. So you can definitely trace a lot of resistance in these sources.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that Caribbean context, I think, is so interesting. And I think you do a good job of really showing what enslaved women themselves were trying to do in light of such a paucity of sources in certain ways. If we can maybe turn to back to the abolition movement and some of the larger political discourses and even sort of legal issues at the time. You talk about one of the more famous cases in the early years of the English abolition movement. That's the case of James Somerset. But you kind of tell it very briefly because you're actually wanting to tell a slightly earlier story about a woman named Mary Hylas, which I think hasn't really gotten a lot of attention, but is in some ways a really crucial context. So for those who may not know the story of James Somerset and the Somerset v. Stuart decision in England, I wonder if you could sort of briefly summarize that, but then also talk about the story of Mary Hylas, which is really crucial to the context behind that, and also maybe how issues of marriage and slavery get bound up in those whole legal discussions.
Absolutely, yeah. The Somerset case is possibly the most famous legal case in the history of British abolitionism, certainly up there in the top five or so. James Somerset was an enslaved man who was brought to England and whose master attempted to forcibly remove him from England back to the colonies. And Somerset's case, he objected, he filed a case under the habeas corpus laws to claim that his master had no right to force a servant out of Great Britain in that way. And this case is seen to have kind of widely established that the laws of slavery, colonial laws of slavery, did not apply in England. So while that case is very famous and establishes kind of marks the onset of the age of abolition, I think historians would say, at the same time, I find this case of Mary Hylas, who was Dahl's mother, also has really important implications. It's similar, but it's different. And I think deserves equal claim to fame in the history of slavery and abolition. Mary Hylas, I started looking into her case because she's Dahl's mother, and I was interested in knowing more about the family. But I was really delighted to discover that Mary's story was equally fascinating and provided its own sort of window onto the history of reproduction, the politics of reproduction. Mary Hylas traveled with the owners of Newton Plantation as a sort of maid servant to Great Britain. She traveled as a maid servant to her mistress to Great Britain. And while she was there, she married a formerly enslaved man, John Hylas. She later returned to the Caribbean with her mistress. And afterward, John Hylas filed a lawsuit against the Newtons, against her owners, saying that they had unlawfully taken his wife away from him and asking for damages. So this case was heard in the late 1760s before the Somerset case. It was an early case in which Grandel Sharp, who later was pivotal in pushing forward the Somerset case. Granville Sharp also became involved in this case with Mary Hylas slightly earlier. And the records related to the case indicate that there was some discussion of whether her husband or her master had a greater claim to her. So it was this case about the relationship between slavery and marriage. It didn't resolve well for John Hylas. He was given a sort of, I think it was a penny. He was given a really small amount of money as a kind of token gesture. Mary Hylas never did return to England. It's unclear why, whether she chose to stay in Barbados, whether she ever even knew about the case is all unclear. But it's interesting, and there are not very extensive records about the arguments. It's mostly Granville Sharp's records that we know anything about the case compared to the Somerset case. But then the Somerset case has really extensive records that indicate that, once again, this question of marriage and slavery, of the relationship between the authority of masters and the authority of husbands, was really pivotal in the Somerset case. And it was a legal question that continued to haunt reformers throughout the age of abolition. As reformers began to think about how to encourage reproduction, many of them landed on the possibility that they could encourage Christian marital mores as a way of encouraging fertility. That was the kind of the logic of the day, was that people were following God's command to increase and to marry, that the ability to increase and multiply would ensue. So it does raise kind of interesting questions about how the attempts to promote marriage would play out in slave societies, and how the authority of fathers and masters might be reconciled.
Yeah, and I was just really fascinated with that description that you have in the book about the ways in which marriage and slavery, from a legal perspective, become debated as similar institutions and similar aspects of dependence. And I thought that was a really fascinating aspect of all this that ties in with your consideration of reproduction generally. So maybe to kind of bring us forward to the actual abolition of the slave trade. So as you mentioned, there's a lot of debate sort of even before, but certainly after the Somerset decision and Mary Hylas's own experiences, in which that question of reproduction and trying to create self-reproducing enslaved populations that wouldn't need the constant influx of Africans coming in. Finally, in 1807, England does abolish the slave trade. So I'm wondering how what the actual abolition of the slave trade did to the debate over enslaved people's bodies and their reproduction, and if there's a transformation after the success of the abolition actually occurs.
Yeah, well, once the abolition actually occurs, once the Atlantic slave trade is abolished, the British Empire is really committed irrevocably to this policy of promoting reproduction as a way to bring the British imperial economy forward and to ensure its continued well-being. And so the imperative to encourage reproduction becomes all the more pressing. And in the aftermath, I find that British politicians become, and colonial governments as well, become kind of obsessed with quantification and with generating data about population size. So I think there's been a lot of interesting work done in our field about the politics of information during this period, and I would point to this as one place where information becomes really crucial to driving policy and to justifying policy. So the registry system in particular that's implemented in the aftermath of the abolition of the Atlantic slave trade is probably the clearest example of this obsession with quantification, where slave owners are required in the British Caribbean colonies to enumerate the enslaved people that they own, to account for losses or gains year to year, and this registry system generates a massive quantity of data that allows British politicians to think more systematically about demography in the Caribbean and about reproduction.
Yeah, and do you see it as being this enumeration of enslaved people? Do you see that kind of joining into Malthusian philosophies, which are really kind of taking off in the early 19th century? Is it transforming that debate, or is it just sort of subject to Malthusian viewpoints?
I've been really interested in the course of writing this book in understanding how Malthusian ideas about demography relate to the Atlantic slave trade. Malthus, of course, is widely considered to be the father of modern demography, and yet most of his work was not focused on the Caribbean. It was actually a subject that he was kind of reluctant to address, and only in the kind of climactic debates about, in the years leading up to the climactic debates about the Atlantic slave trade, did he make a revision to his work in order to account for the situation in the Caribbean. And I think that intervention did end up being pivotal, and Wilberforce claimed that he had helped the cause of abolitionism along by saying that there was indeed some kind of catastrophic demographic situation going on in the Caribbean that needed to be addressed. But in terms of Malthusian ideas about the mechanics of population growth, about how population growth works, I think that he made a couple of really significant interventions that had that informed the way that slave owners and colonial governments, British politicians, thought about how to manage the reproduction in the Caribbean for decades to come. That still inform our ways of thinking about these things. Firstly, I think that he blamed the sexual indiscretion of laborers for problems with reproduction. That this was something that he used this line of thinking both in Great Britain and in the Caribbean. In the Caribbean, his particular concern was that if slave populations were lagging, there must have been some kind of moral catastrophe going on. So he basically blames sexual irregularities in the Caribbean for the decline of populations there. In Great Britain, on the other hand, he thinks that that laborers are reproducing too quickly, but it's still the fault of the laborers and their sexual decisions that they're having too much sex, and this is creating too many people in that case. So it goes kind of either way for Malthus, but in the case of the Caribbean, it's a problem of undersupply also caused by too much sex. And the outgrowth of that for Malthus, I think, is that laboring people should be responsible for the cost of their own reproduction, that this is a way to get them to kind of moderate their sexual behavior, to tailor it to the needs of the labor market at a given time. And this idea that that laborers have to be constantly conscious of their ability to reproduce, of the demands of the labor market, that this justifies policies in the aftermath of the abolition of the slave trade and of slavery, such as charging mothers for health care for their children, that you see slave owners and British politicians saying, well, you know, parents have to be responsible for their children or for their decision to have children. And so ultimately, these kind of poultry rations, food rations, medical rations that we had been giving them under slavery, really now these are their responsibility. So there's this kind of ethic of parental responsibility that's embedded in Malthusian demography that I think is really pivotal in the during the Age of Abolition and in the aftermath of the decision to abolish slavery.
But I was going to ask you about the issue of matrimony in the Caribbean, because that kind of comes out of that issue around Malthusian demography. And you talk about sort of this increased responsibility put on even free women of color in the Caribbean. And I wonder if you could sort of talk about the religious reform movements of the early 19th century and how they connect with that issue of reproduction, but more on the side of freedom than necessarily entirely on slavery.
I was interested in the role that missionaries play in encouraging Christian marital mores in an effort to promote reproduction. And so I took a closer look at the Methodist missionary records related to Barbados, to the island where Dahl lived. And I was interested in how free women of color related to the Methodist mission, and how the work of the Methodist missionaries reshaped the economy in which free women of color operated. There was certainly among Methodist missionaries an emphasis on nuclear families, on families that were centered on the authority of the father. This was something new for free women of color who had previously basically been kind of ruled out of marriage as an option. In cases where there weren't legal prescriptions, in practice, free women of color rarely had legally recognized marriages. So involvement in the Methodist mission meant for free women of color that they were involving themselves in a new idea, a new kinship structure that hadn't previously been the norm. One example is Sarah Ann Gill, who took on a leadership role in the Barbados mission. There was a period when the Methodist missionary William Shrewsbury was chased off the island by people who were outraged by his preaching. And in that time, Sarah Ann Gill, this free woman of color in Barbados, took on a leading role in the mission. She became kind of correspondent, the local correspondent for the Methodist missionaries. And she was holding religious meetings in her own lodgings and so on. So this was an opportunity for someone like Sarah Ann Gill to exercise a new kind of leadership in Bajan society. But at the same time, it led her into negotiating a new kind of economy of sex, in that she, unlike free women of color of a previous generation, she was under a lot of pressure to conform to Christian marital mores, and seems to have embraced that that direction in her own life. So the situation for women like Sarah Ann Gill, who were involved in these paternalistic family structures meshed in them, was rather different. One example would be in terms of inheritance. So there's been a lot of good work done to illustrate, and I review some of this. Pedro Welch and others have talked about the ability of free women of color who were not married to make their own decisions about how to leave property, who would inherit their property after they died. But the women of this rising generation, of which I think Gill is emblematic, were instead enmeshed in legal constraints about the patrilineal descent of property that didn't give them quite the same freedoms as they had had previously.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you could just say a little bit to maybe kind of wrap up about this, because I think that you do the chronology is a really interesting one of this examination of enslaved women's bodies and this transition in the religious reform movements of the 19th century into a supervision over matrimony. And I wonder what the legacy of these debates are even beyond this period of slavery and emancipation.
I think that some of the themes that come forward during the age of abolition, the themes in the governance of reproduction are themes that continue to play out to this day in governmental involvement in reproduction. So themes like the importance of parental responsibility and the tendency to kind of to see child rearing as the responsibility of individual parents rather than the community is one that plays out to this day. In the Caribbean specifically, I think that, and Juanita de Barros has done some really wonderful work on how this plays out through the 20th century, that concerns about venereal disease were one way in which sexuality and reproduction in the Caribbean were managed. The concerns about venereal disease were used as an excuse in some ways, if I can put it that way, for governments to intervene in the sexual lives of people in the Caribbean. Also, the regulation of birthing practices is a kind of running theme in the history of the Caribbean through the 20th century. Things like baby-saving leagues, attempts to train local midwives persisted into the 20th century and created similar hierarchies of power to what I've described with Dahl, in that British women were and local white women were put in positions of power as trainers and as kind of instructors in domestic hygiene over Afro-Caribbean women.
Yeah, it's a really interesting long durée story of the ways in which those issues haven't quite washed out. I want to come to close to see if you want to talk a little about the project that you're working on now. I know that you have sort of dealt with the issues of medicalization a little bit in this book, but I was wondering if you could talk about the new project that you're working on at the moment.
Yeah, I'm currently at work on a second book about the history of venereal disease in the Atlantic world, and particularly the slave societies of the Caribbean and North America. I'm interested, obviously this stems from my the research in my first book, where I became interested in understanding how doctors understood the causes of infertility among Afro-Caribbean women, and began exploring their ideas about venereal disease. And I became intrigued in particular by the relationship between two disease categories and how that evolves over time, the two diseases being yaws and syphilis. I was intrigued because on the one hand, many modern medical authorities see yaws and syphilis as more or less the same disease. The germ that causes them is identical under a microscope. The symptoms are similar qualitatively. And yet, these two disease categories have very different histories. And on the one hand, syphilis, the story is pretty well known among Europeans, was seen as this sexualized disease. And then on the other hand, as I dug through the sources and I looked at accounts of women in Africa, in the Caribbean, a few male healers too, but many women are described as treating yaws in a particular way as a childhood disease, as something that could be that inoculation could prove effective in treating. And so this discrepancy is fascinating, and it's fascinating to see healers, both healers of, you know, white healers, and also healers of African descent, kind of and grappling with these two disease categories and the relationship between them, and trying to figure out how whether this disease is really related to sex in some way or not. So I think it's a story that says a lot about the possibility for culture to shape our ideas about disease, and for disease concepts to become bound up in all sorts of other cultural baggage about sex and race.
Well, that sounds really interesting. I'm looking forward to seeing that that come out. Well, thank you so much for joining me on to discuss the book. I think it's a really fascinating study of not only the era of abolition and slavery in the Caribbean, but also the ways in which reproduction and women's health become a really crucial part of that.
Thanks so much, Dan, for having me. It's a pleasure.
Right. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.